Hi, my name is Bruce Bolger, and I'm the founder of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance. We're a think tank and outreach group focusing on a strategic and systematic approach to stakeholder management across the enterprise. And today we're going to be talking about the impact of the European Union Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which to this date in the United States has received almost no media coverage. We're going to ask Heiko about that in a few minutes as well, about the European Union. But it has received a ton of coverage from all the law firms practically, and from also many of the management consulting companies. So it seemed to us to make sense here at the EA to get two people on this show to give us a good sense of what this new directive is and how it will affect the United States and how it will affect Europe. And so to do that, we have Carmen Liu. She's a counsel for Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, and she's a specialist in ESG, corporate governance, and mergers and acquisitions. And we have Dr. Heiko Morderer. He's board member, senior partner of 4C Group Management Consultancy. And Heiko is in a very unique world of one of the few people who has ever conducted a true human capital audit at a major corporation for 30414 standards. And he is an expert in human capital standards. So just to remind everybody that, that the Enterprise Engagement Alliance provides a bunch of free resources. We really have a stakeholder capitalism approach of giving away a lot of free information on how to implement what in effect is total quality management for people. And then we have all sorts of allies who help utilize our services, and in utilizing our services, they help you gain access to more information. So I'm now going to stop this share, if it will let me, and bring in our guests. And there we go. Great. Carmen, thank you so much for taking your time today to join us on this. And first off, could you explain, please, what the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive is in the European Union in brief, simple words? And what impact would you expect it to potentially have on U.S. companies?
Thanks, Bruce. I think to put it very simply, last year, the European Union adopted what's called the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. And basically what it expands on is existing kind of disclosure requirements for companies, kind of on ESG related disclosures. It's far more extensive. It uses this concept of double materiality reporting. And I think for US companies in particular, for the first time, what it means is that, you know, either their subsidiaries or the entire parent company could be required to report under this directive. And I think what is interesting about the directive is that it will be adopted by member states. So it could vary from country to country. And I think the final scope of the disclosures remains to be seen. They will be finalized at some point around June this year. And they cover a wide variety of topics and are far more extensive than any of the SEC disclosure rules that are currently being tabled.
And we're going to get into more detail in a minute, Carmen. So thank you for that intro. Heiko, in Europe, this is going to have a direct effect on potentially tens of thousands of companies that are already, as Carmen said, complying with an earlier, with the current directive in effect. How much buzz is there in Europe about this? You have leading clients that, you know, would be the equivalent of Fortune 1000 companies. How much buzz is there in the C-suite? What are you seeing?
So first of all, thanks, Bruce, for having me. I really appreciate this. And so hello, everyone, again. I'm really thrilled to have this opportunity to talk to you about this new European sustainability reporting standard. And there is almost no buzz at all to answer your question, Bruce. That is kind of amazing. And we also do not understand this, because this is not going to be a voluntary standard. This is going to be a regulation in Europe. And for companies that operate in Europe to a certain extent. So this is going to be mandatory, and this is also going to be audited. This is why I'm really cannot understand at the moment why most of the companies are in a hibernating mode at the moment. So there are a few companies who are aware of this upcoming regulation, because this is a regulation, this is not a voluntary standard, as I already mentioned, and they are kind of aware of the standards, and they are aware of the fields that this standard or the disclosure areas that this standard is covering. And some are even thinking about, you know, getting prepared. But I don't know one company at the moment in Europe who is really already in the middle of the preparation for this regulation. And as you already mentioned, there are basically over 40,000 companies and organizations in Europe that will be covered by this standard.
And what we're going to get to in shortly is the fact that there are no auditors yet. There's no auditing criteria yet, and their audits are required. We'll get to that. Carmen, one of the things that really is remarkable, and I've read now the draft regulations, and as you pointed out, it's a directive, which means that each country in the European Union will have an opportunity to craft it for its own self, and that will take some time. But I was stunned by the scope of disclosure requirements, but I'd like to get your view. But this is way beyond the SEC. It seems the Securities and Exchange Commission has way beyond what they've even ever talked about requiring. And we're talking about potentially hundreds of data points. And what most struck me, Carmen, but I'd like you to comment on it, is that it addresses all stakeholders. In other words, not just employees, but the employees of my supply chain and distribution partners up, you know, upstream and downstream. And then I have to address how I treat my customers, and I have to address how I treat the communities and our communities, and on top of that, the environment. But could you go into a little bit more detail, you know, as to the depth, I mean, to the scope of these requirements?
Right. I think Rishi raised a very important point about what differentiates CSRD versus what we've already seen in terms of kind of the voluntary reporting that many companies have currently adopted and what we've seen in the US through the SEC's disclosure rules. I think the key difference, you know, as you mentioned, is this reference to stakeholders. And I think at the core of these disclosures is this concept of double materiality, which kind of loops in, I think, a company's impact, not, you know, just simply, you know, focuses on in a company's impact on its own business, but also its impact on the environment, the communities in which it operates, suppliers, its customers, employees, and so forth. And I think that really differentiates CSRD from what we've seen from SASB and TCFD, and what we've also seen from the SEC's proposed rules, which are much more focused on kind of financial materiality as it relates to the company's operations. Under the new rules, companies will have to disclose, you know, what are the impacts, the negative externalities they have on affected communities, for example. What are the externalities they have on workers up and down the value chain? And I think they also need to demonstrate kind of, you know, disclosures relating to externalities on pollution. So it's quite extensive in terms of subject matter. And I think most importantly, it's going to ask companies really to disclose and assess very clearly what their externalities are, and also take steps to kind of figure out how do you mitigate and address these externalities. And I think that's a real game changer here.
Well, Carmen, I want to ask you to expand on that for a minute, because, and I know we're not bringing you into the stakeholder capitalism ESG discussion, you're an attorney, but one of the key, you know, the key advocates of stakeholder capitalism basically say the only corporate social responsibility of a corporation is to not put any externalities on society. In other words, and when you read the European Union justification for these reports, and you've read them as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of them is we want to see to the extent to which a company is offloading its externalities onto society, and investors and employees and customers have a right to know what a company's practices are. Am I misreading that, or does that seem to be the real intent?
Yeah, I think there is certainly an intent under the new disclosure framework to have companies more explicitly disclose their impacts on the broader community that they operate in. And I think that is obviously kind of part of, I think, what we're seeing kind of a global trend, a global shift towards state capitalism. For a long time, I think the dominant narrative has been kind of enhancing shareholder value. And I think there's now, over the last decade or so, both in the United States and also for many years, you know, in the EU, this recognition that stakeholder interests need to be considered. And I think, you know, coming from the US perspective, you know, corporate law in Delaware has always permitted boards and management to consider the interests of their stakeholders while forming their business judgment. And so this is not anything particularly new, but I think there is an added degree of emphasis and disclosure, which we're now seeing in the CSRD framework, which I think will force companies to, I think, do a much more deeper dive in terms of the externalities and actually document that and disclose that publicly. And that's a real significant shift from what we've seen in previous years.
So Heiko, and this is going to apply to you too, Carmen, in a minute. You know, the real issue is, and I'm moving around some of the orders of our questions here, who's going to be in charge of this? Who's going to do it? Now, Heiko, you've been involved with only some of the very few human capital audits that have been done anywhere. So it would seem to me in the U.S., though, generally, when there are disclosures, it's the attorneys who are in charge and they're running it. Do you think in the case of stakeholder management disclosures of this magnitude that lawyers can really be the charge on? Of course, we're going to need attorneys. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But who's going to be in charge, do you think, of managing this process? And this is a two-part question to both of you. Should companies view this as a disclosure requirement, or should they view it as a disclosure opportunity?
So first of all, if you look at the disclosure areas that this regulation covers or is going to cover, this is not only about human capital topics, and it's not only about stakeholder and supply chain partners, but it's also about all the pillars, you might say, in the ESG area. This means this regulation covers environmental aspects like climate change topics, like pollution, like water and marine resources. It covers the S, the social aspects of ESG, like, your own workforce and workers in your value chain, for example, but also, and this is very important, affected communities. So this regulation really relates to the fact that companies and organizations do not only impact with their business, their clients and their employees and their own workforce, but they also impact all the supply chain partners and the communities they are acting in and they are allocated in. So this is a new topic, and it also covers aspects of the G in ESG. So governance, the governance area, like, governance, risk management, internal control systems, business conduct topics. So what this means is there cannot be this one specific function or area within a company or organization that is able to cover all these areas. I think, if you look at this regulation and it's also mandatory that this disclosure is part of the annual report of companies in the future. The annual report, this is not going to be somewhere, hidden somewhere in your webpage. This is going to be in an integral part of your annual report. So from my understanding, this is a strategic topic. Companies should try to turn this into a strategic opportunity. But I think this is a topic that should be addressed at the top management level of a company, probably on a CEO, CFO level, in order to, have the chance and the ability to gather this information and to, put all these topics together that this regulation is covering at the moment or will be covering.
Carmen, so getting down to the actual, because you're going to start getting, people start asking, what do we do, right? So this seems to me that, as Heiko is alluding, this is a cross-functional process, right? It involves marketing, sales, operation, because it's customers, it's community relations. So this is not, you don't give this to your CSR person, it doesn't seem. Now, and also I can't just turn this over to my attorney because the attorney doesn't. How would you, Carmen, have you given some thought, or maybe this is out of your scope, as to how organizations should manage this? And do you think they should view it as a compliance issue or as a business opportunity issue?
I think there's a lot of great questions here, Bruce. So I'm going to unpack them one by one. I think in terms of, how should a company think about, addressing these new upcoming regulatory requirements? I think, this question has already been posed by companies as they're starting to reframe how do they ensure proper ESG oversight and governance within up and down their reporting lines. And I think, when you look at the broad, subject areas that are being covered under CSRD, and as Heiko mentioned, this is definitely going to be a cross-functional task. And I think a lot of companies have already developed internal task forces comprised of senior executives pulling from different elements of the business who can kind of help oversee the process by which you kind of pull information from the subject matter experts deep down within your management ranks to kind of bring up that information that is required for disclosure. And I think that's exactly what companies will have to do more of, which is finding the subject matter experts that are already within their businesses. And often it may be several tiers down within their management, folks that who have long been doing reporting, but never really kind of reported straight up to the CEO, CFO, or legal lines, but will now have to play a much larger role in terms of kind of complying with these disclosures. And the expertise, I think what is surprising is a lot of companies have that expertise in-house and are already starting to build that expertise in-house. And that may also need to be supplemented by external advisors, right? So that the whole kind of, consultants who can assist in terms of calculating greenhouse gas inventories, particularly for smaller companies that don't really have the reporting framework and processes currently in place. And then I think in terms of where lawyers come into play, I think, in the US in particular, because companies are going to be navigating different reporting regimes, it's not just CSRD or the SEC. You also have a slew of up and coming potential, federal laws that require disclosures, particularly for companies that say, for example, are government contractors. And then you also have reporting regimes that are appearing in Canada, your regimes that are appearing in the UK, regimes that are appearing in Australia. And I think that's where the legal team needs to come in and not only see this as kind of a compliance issue, but also a risk mitigation problem, right? Because, disclosures, as we've already seen, poor disclosures, greenwashing in particular, can create severe reputational harm and damage to a company. And kind of being able to manage and control the different reporting requirements and ensure that not only are they compliant, but they're also not, incomplete and misleading, depending on the jurisdictions you're kind of complying with. I think those are all the questions that lawyers and legal teams need to have this thought through in the coming years. And I think in terms of thinking of it as an opportunity, for the longest time, I think any public disclosure is both a risk and opportunity from our perspective, right? It's a great way to showcase what a company has done and may ensure that it's getting credit from its investors, because investors don't always have insight into what's happening internally within a business. And, conversations with investment teams, stewardship teams only go so far. And sometimes, a lot of the messaging goes through public disclosures. That being said, I think in the US in particular, we're also in a particularly more litigious kind of environment. And companies should be really careful that what they're putting out there isn't going to become fodder for the plaintiff's bar as well and create kind of frivolous lawsuits regarding kind of, what they're doing. And on top of that, I think, we're also seeing kind of a level of political, division on certain of these kind of matters. And I think companies, again, need to kind of apply this heightened scrutiny. And again, I think this is where the legal teams come into play alongside, I think, the IR teams and also the government relations team. So I think it's really going to be a massive team effort. And I think that's where companies need to start focusing now, which is figuring out who your different players are going to be, where your reporting lines are going to be, and getting all the folks up to date as to what the requirements are going to be. Because this isn't going to be something you have to do tomorrow, but this is something I think a lot of US companies who are multinationals are going to have to start putting into place in the next 2 to 3 years and really be ready to start reporting as early as 25.
Yeah, I think everybody has to understand that technically it is in effect now, but companies will not have to report the largest companies until 25, but that will be for 24. 2024 is 9 months from now. That is nothing in business. So Heiko, I want to clear up so the companies leave this or who see this show leave with a framework. So what we're really saying is that A, the CEO has to get her or his hands around this with the CFO, with the board. And I'm going to talk a little bit about expertise in a minute, Carmen, because I don't think, this whole stakeholder thinking is very, very new. And I don't think it's taught in business schools. It's not taught in law schools. So that's another issue. But so then we need to have a task force, it seems. And it seems it needs to be a cross-functional task force. seems like it needs to be, every task force usually should have somebody leading it, and that person should have some knowledge of ESG or of certainly the concept of stakeholder management. And I'm going to ask you folks to tell me if I'm wrong. And then finally, you've got to do it with your attorney. And you can't just use any attorney. I'm sorry. There are not that many attorneys. This is not an advertisement for Ms. Liu here, because she wouldn't want me to do that. But in fact, there are not that many attorneys who have a clue about this. So Heiko, you've actually done it. You've actually done with major corporations, ISO 30414 audits. And so I'm going to ask you two questions. A, is my explanation and Carmen's explanation of who's involved kind of correct, or have you seen different? And secondly, do you see some issues with capabilities on, because stakeholder thinking, cross-functional thinking is really not built into the Western capitalist model. We're very siloed. Your thoughts?
So first of all, I'm completely in line with Carmen's thinking, because this is definitely a cross-functional topic. And this is an all hands on deck situation from my perspective, across silo or cross functional topic as well. So I completely agree with this one. And I also think that this is probably one of the biggest challenges in this whole topic, to have a cross silo based approach to deliver against these regulations. Because the thing is, and now to your second question, so even if you are able to gather all the information, you know, with a cross-silo approach, what are you then doing if the results are not as you expected or as external auditors may expect them to be? So this is not only a information gathering and disclosure exercise. We're talking about transforming organizations in order to enable them to meet these regulations and to become someone in the future compliant. So this we're talking about is, from my perspective, a huge transformation for a lot of organizations and for a lot of companies. And, you know, if you compare this to, for example, the ISO standard 30414 human capital reporting, there you also have basically, you know, two basic topics to, you know, become compliant to this guideline. So first of all, you have to get your whole human capital reporting fixed and aligned to the standards. And, you know, you have to adopt the standard in the first instance. But to do this, you have to understand the standard, and then you can adopt the standard and you can transform your human capital reporting accordingly. And then the second step is the audit. So in this case, I would also recommend to do it this way. So first of all, your companies have to understand the requirements, and there are really requirements, you know, embedded into these standards from the European Union. And then to implement the requirements of these standards, and then they can gather the relevant information and disclose these standards. So this is, from my perspective, really not only a disclosure aspect, and not only a topic about gathering information. This is about getting the processes and the organization in place and transforming the processes and transforming the organization in order to be, you know, at a point where you can disclose this information. Well, does this answer your question, Bruce?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, perfect. And this brings me back to Carmen. Now, I was very involved with the total quality management movement back in the 90s, and it was really a 10-year movement of applying, and I think it's very similar, applying a strategic and systematic approach to quality rather than being reactive and ad hoc. And I think we're talking very much the same about people. But the issue here is that it has become politicized, but we'll get to that at the end. Not in Europe, but here in the U.S., but to you, Carmen, I ask, when you're starting a total quality management effort, the first thing you do is start getting your data. That's the first thing you do. You have to get a baseline. Where are we? Mm-hmm. So it seems to me, if companies are being nonchalant about this and just kind of sitting on their hands and they're not acting on it, they're going to have a lot of very unpleasant surprises when, as Heiko says, they start getting the data. And the disclosures aren't going to be very pretty. Like one of the things that they have to disclose is turnover. I don't think most people know that hasn't been finalized, but Carmen, I saw that. It says employee turnover. I don't know one CEO in the world who wants to, or maybe a few who have low turnover, who wants to brag about that. So my question to you is, Carmen, what sign do you, and I'm going to ask you, I get that the media hasn't covered it all. What sign is it that corporations are beginning to realize they better get their act together, that the clock is ticking on this?
Yeah, I think if we look at kind of the arc of corporate disclosures in the ESG sphere over the last 5 years, we've seen tremendous change. And I think, for much of the time, candidly, I think a lot of companies have been trying to play catch up and trying to keep up with kind of all the changes. We saw the adoption of SASB and TCFD by a very large number of companies over the last couple of years. And then now that's starting to evolve into the ISSB rules. And then now companies also grappling of what do you do with the forthcoming SEC rules in the United States, alongside, whether it relates to climate, human capital, board diversity, cybersecurity, and so forth. So I think companies are really trying to evolve their disclosure processes to kind of adapt to the changing regulatory and investor expectations. And I think CSRD is going to be, another challenge that many of them will have to face. That being said, because, many companies, particularly larger companies, have already implemented reporting processes in order to comply with the voluntary standards and in advance of, in anticipation of the SEC climate rules, I think a lot of the principles and processes for gathering and collecting good data are already starting to come into place. Now, that being said, I don't say this is the case for all companies. I think the larger companies are going to be most prepared, and I think a lot of smaller companies are going to struggle in terms of making sure that the data is accurate and reliable, particularly, in the fact with respect to kind of information that becomes more and more granular and moves beyond just climate-related data. I think folks are getting really well prepared in terms of getting, greenhouse gas emissions data. But I think when you move into employee type data and statistics, I think the data sits somewhere in the company. Most companies do collect this data. The question is, how do you gather it? How do you ensure that it's actually accurate? Time and time again, we've seen companies review the EEO-1 data and realize, actually, we need to take a closer look to make sure the numbers are actually truly correct. And so I think the next 18 months is going to present a huge challenge, not just for companies, but I also think for kind of the audit community too, because for the first time, I think, auditors are kind of faced with the task of how do you audit information that's never really been audited before. Metrics are completely new, data that's being collected for the first time ever. And, we already know there's a shortage of folks just auditing climate-related data. So I think it remains to be seen, the EU CSRD is going to be fully implemented from an audit perspective. But I think going back to your earlier point, Bruce, I think getting the right data, having the right processes, having monitoring in place, and making sure that's reported up the reporting lines. And I think certain of the data that previously never made it to the board is going to eventually go up to the board now because they're required to be publicly disclosed. So I think getting these processes and underway, I think is going to be should be a really top priority for any public company in the US.
So Heiko, getting to this auditing thing for a moment, it seems to me that that's the one big hole in this. Everything else I've read, I have more, you and I, again, we've been at this longer than most people, so we've been watching it. I don't see where these auditors are. I see where the auditing bodies are. In most country we have here, the acronym escapes my mind, ANSI. We have different in each country.
Yeah.
But don't we have, and I think our European friends overlooked that there's nobody trained to do this. So to Carmen's point, how many people, you and I think there might be two other people in the world, Zahid, a few other people who have ever done a human capital audit. What? I don't think our European friends anticipated the challenges of setting up an auditing practice along the TQM. It took quite a while in total quality management and ISO 9001. Since you have so much experience with ISO, do you have any thoughts on how they're going to address this auditing issue?
So first of all, at the moment, it is planned to introduce the obligation for external auditing or verification, however you might call it, of this new form of sustainability reports. And it's also planned that violations of the standards can be sanctioned, you know, with publication, with orders, and also with fines. And the details of these sanctions are regulated by the European Union member states at national level. So that's, first of all, the situation at the moment that it's planned, that there should be external auditing for these disclosure requirements, you might say. And then there is another aspect. So who will be the certification or the auditing bodies who should do this? And first of all, there is the question, which organizations have the skills and capabilities to do this, right? And which organization has the skills and capabilities to decide which organizations should be the decision body, or the auditing body. So there are accreditation organizations in each and every country. They probably should think about setting up accreditation processes to figure out which companies or which future auditing bodies should be the ones that should get the accreditation to do these certifications or to do these audits. But this is still, you know, very blur somewhere in the future. But at the end, it only makes sense that organizations do these audits that are really skilled and capable to cover these areas that the standards are covering. And this is not only human capital reporting.
I know.
And not only stakeholder engagement. That's
environment.
That's far more. And for me, the most important aspect, as I already mentioned, is which companies have the capabilities to do this and who should be the accreditation body to decide upon this.
Well, we know from ISO, we have history. The same thing was done. You know, ISO 9001 was not government mandated, ever, never has been, but it effectively was mandated by Fortune 500 companies who basically had needed everybody in their supply chain to comply. So ISO 9000, no one knows for sure, but there's an estimate about 1.2 million companies have some sort of ISO certification. Now, 80% of them, Carbon, you'll find this interesting, rule of thumb, about 80% just do it as a compliance issue. Check off the box. General Motors requires me to do it. Okay. This isn't going to be so easy to get away with, I don't think. But it's going to create, you know, the Total Quality Management created an entire industry of auditors. They have a trade show every 2 years. So I think we're going to see this create a lot of business opportunities for the right people. But Carmen, getting back to now the impact. I want to get a little bit more granular here in the U.S. Because Europe, it's very clear cut. You have over 250 employees or $40 million or euros. You know, there's certain cutoffs, very clear. In the U.S., though, I think we're going to give me a sense. Do you think the impact could be bigger or less than the GDPR, you know, the General Data Protection Regulations? They had a tremendous effect in the U.S., way beyond. You know, most companies are following them now in the U.S. and they don't even have to, but because they have European clients, they feel, what the hell, I'll just do it. Like, say, California, if you have to comply with a regulation in California, you usually end up just doing it all around the country. What is the real broad impact? In most companies, if you do business with a European company, can you ignore it? How much impact will this have?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big difference between CSRD versus GDPR is in terms of scope. You know, who does it impact? GDPR basically hits almost everybody. If you have some sort of, you know, tangential relationship with the European Union, you're going to have to address GDPR. In CSRD, however, is a bit narrower in scope in terms of scope of companies it will potentially impact, but the depth of kind of the disclosures is, I think, really unprecedented, right? So just to kind of give you kind of overview, you know, there are kind of two tiers of disclosures, right? So if you could either be in a US multinational company, and if you're past a certain threshold, you as a US parent company will need to disclose against CSRD. There's also the instance where, say, for example, you don't have a particularly, you know, strong business ties to Europe, but you do have significant subsidiaries that pass certain thresholds under CSRD. Now, then those subsidiaries will have to disclose against CSRD. So I think what ultimately it means, I think, is for most of the largest US companies, you know, almost all of them will probably do some sort of business. And I think threshold here is not particularly high. We're looking at about €150 million in total, you know, revenue net turnover in the European Union as a threshold for an entire company, an entire parent company to start reporting. So I think many of the larger companies in the US are going to be impacted by CSRD. And they will be, I think, you know, faced with kind of the decision of, you know, how do you juggle the different reporting standards? But I wouldn't compare CSRD with GDPR for the reason that, you know, GDPR was really more of a compliance question. Here, I think we're looking at significant disclosures that could bring up litigation issues. It could create investor questions. It could create, it really asks companies to reinvent their entire kind of reporting wheelhouse in many respects. And then I think also really, you know, because of the nature of these disclosures, many of them are focused on like strategic questions. Like not only are you disclosing risks and problems, it's also about how you're taking steps to mitigate them. So I think CSRD is also going to really reshape how companies do business as well. And I think that makes it really different from GDPR, which is more, I think, an exercise of implementing the right frameworks to comply with the regulation.
So one question along these lines, as we alluded to earlier, the whole ESG issue has become politicized. We would argue it's based on a false definition about companies taking profits and to fund pet issues. That's another issue. But I would imagine when the news gets out about this, there are going to be some people on the right that are pretty freaked out about this. Is there going to be any legal recourse in the U.S. If I'm doing business with Europe, can I, or if I'm an angry Louisiana governor, can I sue to have the companies in Louisiana exempt from this? Is there going to be any legal recourse?
You know, I think the recourse is unfortunately going to be very limited for those who are eager to litigate CSRD in the U.S. I think one analogy to draw is, you know, for the longest time, you know, the US and the EU had very different antitrust regimes, and that did not stop the EU from imposing significant penalties on US companies. And I think really, you know, we're looking at kind of a similar situation here, whereas if you're a US company and you're under EU jurisdiction, you will need to comply with CSRD, or some of your subsidiaries will need to comply with CSRD. And while there may be, I think, a lot of political concerns domestically about the fact that you know U.S. companies are under this kind of regime, I think this is ultimately going to be the cost of doing business in the EU. If you want presence in the EU, this is the rules you have to comply with, for the same reason that EU companies doing business in the U.S. also have to comply with certain U.S. laws. That is not going to obviously stop, efforts, as you mentioned, Bruce, earlier about, the ongoing politicization of ESG and efforts within certain states to kind of push back on certain types of ESG related investments, for example, which we're currently seeing. I think that will continue proceeding at pace, but I think we're going to really see kind of that operating in a very separate manner to kind of any to CSRD. I think there just wouldn't be much recourse for state governments or state legislatures, where most of the pushback against ESG is coming from in the US against the European framework.
I'm going to get to you in a minute, Heiko, and we're getting toward the end here. So I have a question here, though, Carmen. What about companies that do business with these companies, the 1,000 U.S. companies that would, or probably more than that, that are going to have to comply? But if I'm a company that does business with them, they're going to probably be sending me out information, aren't they, in their request for proposals, or they're going to ask me to provide a report. So what kind of downstream impact you think, like if I'm a major distributor for Heineken beer, or if I'm a major, sub manufacturer supply chain partner for one of these companies, do I have to start thinking about this too?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, Bruce. I think we're already starting to see this through other kind of disclosure regimes. And I think CSRD is just going to, I think, you know, further amplify the downstream impacts of reporting simply because the scope of disclosures that are covered under CSRD would include supply chains. And so there could be a situation where companies will have to, you know, look down, up and down the supply chains and ask their suppliers to provide additional information in a similar way that, you know, certain, for example, the Uyghur, you know, Forced Labor Protection Act currently requires companies to really kind of interrogate, you know, whether or not there is forced labor throughout the various tiers of the supply chains. We're now going to see CSRD kind of impose similar kind of requirements to really kind of figure out what is going on, even if, you know, the company is not directly kind of in control. They will need to look at their customers. They need to look at their suppliers in particular. And I think that's, and you know, I think this is something that, you know, I think U.S. companies and suppliers globally actually will need to start thinking about the fact that, yes, they could all be kind of tied into the CSRD reporting framework. I think the way we think about it is ultimately we're seeing a convergence towards the most rigorous reporting regime. So, you know, I think, you know, as much as, you know, maybe some of the SEC rules give U.S. companies heartburn, ultimately, I think for the largest companies and then with the trickle down impact, as you mentioned, I think we're all going to start converging towards, I think, the most rigorous form of disclosure. By virtue of the fact that we remain a global economy, and companies are intimately tied in supply chains, remain very efficient, and because of that, you know, I think it really means that a lot of different bodies are all going to be captured under a single disclosure regime.
Now, this would also mean for a smaller company, they might not necessarily have to go out and get an audited report, but it might be good thinking for them to begin to prepare for the fact that they're going to get more requests about this information. And if they themselves don't meet the reporting threshold, I would still think that they would be smart, and I'll get your thought on this, Heiko, to also pay attention to this and to be able to answer some questions in RFPs, or do you think they can just ignore it? First you, Carmen, and then you, Heiko.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a potential business advantage in the future, especially if we're seeing enforcement actions and penalties taken against companies for reporting correct data. That's really going to reverberate down the supplier chain. And so suppliers who are able to provide information that's accurate and have a reputation doing so are going to be those who are going to be, you know, moved up the list of preferred suppliers. So I think there's a business advantage doing that.
Heiko, that's my first question to you, and then I'm going to ask you another question. But what is your view on the impact on smaller companies that wouldn't ordinarily meet the threshold, but do business with companies that do?
So first of all, these new reporting rules apply certainly to all large companies and to all companies listed on regulated markets, except micro enterprises. But these rules also apply to listed small and medium enterprises, you know, taking into account their specific characteristics. And that's very important here to understand that also SMEs, so small and medium enterprises, will be affected by these regulations and by these disclosure requirements. But in the end, this is going to change how companies are doing business. I'm convinced about this one, because companies will think about with what kind of supplier do we want to make business in the future, but also the other way around, with what kind of client or customer do we want to make business in the future. And this is going to change the way the whole supply chain will be organized and managed from my perspective. So to directly answer your question, also, small and medium enterprises should be well prepared as soon as this regulation is going to be effective. That's one thing. And another aspect within that regard is, you know, from a investor's and analyst point of view, this is going to be very interesting, you know, because investors and analysts are looking for assets and they're investing in. And more assets that, you know, fulfill the desire of investors to invest into assets that have a high standard with regards to corporate governance and with regards to ESG And this regulation will lead to a extremely high level of transparency about these aspects in the future. So from an investor's and analyst point of view, this is going to be, you know, like the next gold rush and, you know, like a situation where they can, you know, choose the assets they're investing in with a much higher precision regarding their own requirements for assets they want to invest in. And this is also going to change the world of business in the future.
Well, the very interesting thing, Carmen, as you know, one of the requirements is that everybody has to file the information electronically. They can't just send in a handwritten letter, which means it's going into a database. And then that database is going to be publicly available to everybody. So you can imagine what the analysts are going to go to town. The analytics companies are going to be able to scrape that data and do a tremendous amount of analytics. So wrapping up in a minute here, one of the big things I see, I'm older than both of you, and I've been at this longer than most people simply by age. I've been at it since 1987, this whole human capital movement. I see a massive lack of expertise. There is no education on stakeholder management. They're at University of Virginia, Darden, and there is professors at North Dartmouth and other schools that teach this. But very few CEOs, very few boards are really trained in this. And Heiko, you were telling me that in Europe, the stakeholder approach is even less, or maybe this concept of stakeholder capitalism is even less being discussed. That ironically, as progressive as Europe is in some respects, you guys are really kind of, you're very siloed over there, aren't you? You have a stakeholder issue in terms of education, don't you, or am I wrong?
Well, in Europe, especially the term stakeholder capitalism has a negative connotation, you might say, because of the term capitalism. because even if you are a capitalist in Europe, you wouldn't say you are a capitalist because this whole term definitely has a negative connotation. And we have some laws, especially in Germany, with regards to supply chain management aspects, especially with regards to how to, you know, pick and choose your suppliers and your vendors for your company. But this whole concept of stakeholder capitalism that goes, as you just mentioned, far beyond only choosing the right vendors and the right suppliers for your business, is not established in Europe, definitely not. And this is going to be a challenge because you need, as I already said, the skills and capabilities to do so. I think this is going to be change the way we're doing business, but for the better. And you know, these reports, when they're out there, you know, are they just fig leaves, you know, to cover, you know, unethical behavior? I don't know. But even if they got certified, you know, this doesn't mean that everything is perfectly fine within these companies. No. But I think and I hope that this whole topic will be a journey, right? And that it shows that companies have to care more about these aspects that the regulation is covering. And it's a systematic and strategic approach and an opportunity to become better at getting better for companies. But this is not going to be, you know, kind of like, you know, putting the switch from 0 to 1 and then there are all these nice reports out there and we can build up the database. This is going to be a journey. This is going to be hard work probably. But from my understanding, it's a really good and systematic approach from the European Union to force companies into this kind of thinking, to force companies to cover also other aspects from ESG than only, you know, try to manage your carbon footprint, you might say.
So Carmen, you're going to get the last word. Do we have an expertise gap? Do our business schools have to rethink a little bit their education? By the way, as a quick example, I just was at a meeting and somebody told me they had launched a new product and they didn't look at the impact on other stakeholders and they got creamed because they realized they had major channel conflict and a whole bunch of their customers basically threatened to leave them and hadn't even taken that into account. That Do we have an expertise issue that we have to face in terms of taking a more holistic stakeholder approach, Carmen?
Yeah, I think, you know, echoing Heiko's comments, completely agree. I think we are kind of experiencing kind of a key inflection point today. You know, the shift to stakeholder capitalism has been ongoing for many years, but with kind of the rise of ESG and ESG related issues, I think people are realizing that expertise, particularly at, you know, at the board level, at the CEO, CFO level, there remains to be a lot more to be desired. And I think companies are now starting to realize that it's time to bring in the people internally who have been kind of the subject matter experts, but really haven't had, you know, been able to access senior management, bring them up and having them communicate and share their knowledge with the board and the management is going to be really critical moving forward. And also bring outside experts kind of to ensure that the board is educated in terms of making these decisions, kind of because we are living in kind of a very different paradigm today. I think, as you know, Heiko mentioned, CSRD will change the way companies are doing business. In fact, we're already seeing how ESG is changing the way companies are doing business. And I think that this is really kind of the start of the change, where I think we're really still at the very start of this massive shift away from kind of the Milton Friedman view of thinking that has really dominated, I think, business school thinking for many years. And I think as this continues, there will remain an ongoing need to build up management expertise and board expertise. And we're kind of seeing that, you know, in kind of the SEC kind of, you know, the draft proposals on climate and cybersecurity disclosure, the SEC is asking, well, do you have expertise on your board? And that's really prompted, you know, boards in particular to think, okay, do we need to bring in a singular expert, or do we need to equip ourselves with an amount of sufficient knowledge so that we can make these decisions, knowing that, you know, as board members, ultimately, you are making, you know, decisions on a wide range of subject matters. And maybe what ESG really means is requiring board members to kind of further expand the scope of their knowledge. And doing so may involve bringing up people from management. It may bring people from inside, but I agree. You know, I think everyone is dealing with challenge, from lawyers to advisors to management to boards. We all need to kind of equip ourselves for really kind of a completely new kind of corporate landscape, new expectations for corporate behavior going forward.
Well, as somebody who I think is about a decade out of law school, I think you're at the cutting edge, Carmen, of a whole new generation of attorneys who are going to get trained in what you do. And I think you made a very good choice personally in your direction, because there are not a ton of experts, folks, in ESG law. And we will be putting Carmen's and Heiko's contact information on the bottom of the YouTube show and in the article, so you can feel free to reach out to them. And so I'd like to thank the two of you for taking the time to, I believe, present the first webinar perhaps in the world that I know of in a public media on this new law. I have not seen any other media company cover this other than us, and I have not seen any other media company cover this in a Zoom show or a YouTube show. So thank you again, and we'll be talking soon.